My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
And we go straight into round one, which tests their vocabulary. And for 2 marks, what are the dictionary meanings of the following words? Beginning with Dennis Norton. Dennis, esoteric.
It's one of those sort of excluding words that it means enjoyed or appreciated by a sort of select few. An esoteric joke is one that's only, if I were to say that a thief stole Dillis's handbag and after 3 paces collapsed with a hernia, that would only be understood by the few who know that Dillis's handbag is sort of portable warehouse.
It's a very beautiful illustration, Dennis. I give you your 2 marks straight away. It means designed for or appropriate to an inner circle of disciples or initiates and intelligible only to them, or just generally intellectually pretty exclusive. As opposed to exoteric, which means fit to be communicated to all of us and is the multitude. 2 marks. Dennis Powell. A kickshaw. 1 word.
A kickshaw.
Or it can be kickshaws, if you prefer.
Kickshaw. I thought it meant a kind of hors d'oeuvre, a tiny trifle, a pleasant trifle.
Yes. Are you being terribly complimentary, if you use the word?
Am I?
I want to know.
Frank says no. No.
Well, between you, that's all right. It's a fancy dish in cookery, and it comes from the French quelque chose. Kickshaw, or gewgaw, if you prefer. 2 marks. Frank Noah. Nougatory.
Nougatory?
Yes.
Nothing to do with nougat.
Well, it could be.
Newgate.
Now you're going to realms I can't follow.
Well, it's prison.
Yes.
It was.
Got that.
But it isn't, is it?
Because no.
It wouldn't get you to prison. In fact, it definitely wouldn't get you to prison.
I shouldn't have thought so.
In the sense that it's the sort of thing which is unimportant. More like nougat, actually. Nougatry, it is. It's a sort of useless, pointless bit of rubbish.
We're getting terrible trouble from the sweet manufacturers on that one.
Montelim.
Yes.
It just means harmless.
Yes.
Nougatry.
Yes, you said trifling.
Trifling, yes.
They're saying both those, and then I think you span the meanings. It's trifling, worthless, useless, invalid, futile, inoperative, and so on. Latin word meaning trifles. Anne Scott James.
A parvenu.
Parvenu,
P-A-R-V-E-N-U.
Well, it means a jumped up person.
Yes, it does, literally.
A new arrival. It's usually referred to somebody who's tried to jump out of their social class and gone up.
Yes.
One.
Mm-hmm. And how's it come to mean there?
Well, venu means arrived.
Yes.
I suppose it means freshly arrived or
arrived through. Yes.
Arrived. Through what, one wonders?
Well, through several classes. Through several classes, I think.
Through the help of father.
No, that won't do, Frank. Now, somebody of fairly obscure origin who has either got wealth or position or both, fairly snobbish term, parvenu means simply having arrived, which is a bit unfair to blame anybody for. 2 marks. At this point, I give Frank and Dennis a quotation each to think about for their stories in the last round. And, Frank, yours is, never, 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 never.
Never to the fifth power.
That's it. And for you, Dennis, take a pair of sparkling eyes. We go on to round two, which is a round of distinctive definitions. As I think we know already, a pessimist is a man who wears a belt as well as braces. But for 2 marks, of what type of individual is the following? We begin with Dennis Norton. A man who has no invisible means of support.
Yes, that's quite a famous... I think it was John Buchan, wasn't it?
I think so, but I have argued a bit with Peter Moore about this.
It's an atheist.
Yes, that's right.
Actually, I'm trying to think of another definition I heard. Oh, yes. An atheist is a man who can watch Celtic versus Rangers without caring who wins.
I think that's even better. Peter Moore tells me that there is a certain Bishop Fulton Sheehan who first defined this, but certainly I looked it up and I got John Buchan as the answer too, so take your choice. Tell us, Powell, a man who hath yearnings for equal division of unequal earnings.
A member of the government.
I'd like to be more precise.
More precise.
Precise so you know which government. No, you're on the right track.
He was equal.
For yearnings for equal division of unequal earnings. It's quite an old definition.
Is it now? He's a political character.
Yes, very definitely.
He's a communist. No, well.
Yes. Wouldn't be, would he?
Correct. Be a communist, I suppose.
Would you like to stick to that?
Communist.
Oh, we'll stick to communist.
Yeah, I don't know. I helped you a bit on that. I think 1.5. It's a communist defined by Ebenezer Elliott. The dates get a bit complicated here. He died in 1849. I believe the first reference to a communist in the English language is in 1841. And Marx produced the Communist Manifesto, or the Communist Manifesto was produced in 1848. So it's in that bracket, and it is communist. 1.5. Frank Muir, a man who can't change his mind and won't change the subject.
Bigot.
Yes, I like a synonym for that.
And a bore.
And a bore, too. But try again, because you're nearly there, nearly home. Another word for bigot.
Not a pedant.
Not a pedant.
Not a pedant.
Anybody in the audience? have a dictionary of synonyms about this.
Mr. W.B. Yeats mispronounced it and put the accent on the first syllable, whereas we normally put it on the second, and there are three syllables.
Bigot.
No, it's three
syllables.
Three syllables.
Oh,
I'm sorry, 1.5 again. What I was trying to get at was fanatic.
What a rotten definition of...
Well, it comes from a very distinguished stable. It's as defined by Winston Churchill.
Well, none of us are perfect. the definition of a fanatic is George Santayana, isn't it? The fanatic is one who redoubles his efforts when he's forgotten his aim.
Yes.
That's a real definition.
Yeah, that's a very good one indeed. Anyway, 1.5. And Scott James... A loud noise at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other.
Well, it must refer to a baby.
It does.
It does?
Yes.
Could refer to Concord.
It's a nice thought.
Have I got to say who said it?
No, you'll get your marks without that, but would you like to have a shot?
Bernard Shaw.
Yes, about a contemporary, I think. Perhaps a little younger.
Well, perhaps we'll just sort of...
Just leave it with him, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's a religious character.
Go on, you go.
And the journalist. Father Ronald Knox.
Ah.
But again, there's another shot at this. I looked up a funny thing I've got called Left-Handed Dictionary, which attributed a rather similar saying to somebody called Elizabeth Adamson, whom I'm afraid I didn't know. Anyway, you get your 2 marks. Well, now we have a round of differences. For 2 marks, what's the precise difference, if any, between the following? Dennis Norton, tactics and strategy.
Well, if you were out with a girl and you persuaded her to drink a whole bottle of champagne, that would be tactics. If the week before you went out with her, you sent her one red rose, that would be strategy. If it's long-term planning as against the planning which is forced on you short-term.
Also, Dennis, if you poured a glass from a bottle of champagne, that'll be tactics. But if you drank the rest of the bottle, that'll be very bad strategy. Yeah.
Well, I was trying to get them onto rather more military terms. They seem to be obsessed with girls, both of them. But I'm bound to say that as a set of definitions, I can't fault Dennis, but if I might take it back into the field of combat, tactics is the art of handling forces in battle or in the immediate presence of the enemy, the mechanical movement of troops or things like that set in motion by the dictates of strategy, whereas strategy is very generalship. Directing the military movements and operations, as Dennis says, quite like of the whole campaign. And if you can, doing it so as to impose on the enemy the place and the time and the conditions for fighting, which you yourself prefer rather than the enemy. Rather complicated, but too much. There is power, more material. China and porcelain.
Porcelain is China you can see through. It's translucent. But unlike earthenware, which you can't. It all comes from China.
It all comes from China.
China clay, I think China is.
Isn't China clay? But, I mean, I think, can't you use China to mean a lot? Earthenware and
that's
porcelain?
Right. Yes, that's what I wanted.
So porcelain is also China, but it's a special kind.
That's what I wanted. Yes, the difference is merely a matter of usage. China is perhaps the more homely term. It was originally China ware. Porcelain has perhaps more of a more literary flavour. But they both mean articles of porcelain originally brought from China in the 16th century and then imitated here, and both of them originally were very fine earthenware, white, thin, transparent, or nearly transparent. 2 marks. Thank you. A hip and a whore.
Well, the connection. It's like the difference between a jam and a tart, isn't it? They are in fact horticultural terms.
Yes.
Hip and a whore. You gather them both. The question is, what's the difference? A hip is a part of a rose.
Yes.
It's a kind of knobbly bit that you collect after you've stopped collecting roses. I suppose it's a seed or fruit or something.
Fruit.
And a whore on the whore. On the other hand, said he carefully, a ho is isn't. Yes,
you've got to be a bit more positive than that.
I got a spirit message coming in from the from the east here. It's it's to do with the hawthorn.
Yes,
which, as you know, Jack, is a species of plant used in making hedges.
Yes. Yes. All right. 2 marks. Hip is the fruit of the wild rose or dog rose, or it can be roses in general. Whore is the fruit of the hawthorn. And a whore can also be various other things, including a hedge or an enclosure or a mess sewage. 2 marks. And Scott James. Hay and straw.
Well, hay is dried grass, and straw is dried wheat, I would have thought.
Which bit?
Which bit? Well, the stalky bit.
Yeah. We had to say that, and it isn't the top bit.
No, not the part you make bread out of.
No.
It's the part you make excellent manure out of.
Among other things. Yes, that's all right.
And you can thatch with straw, too.
That's jolly good, yes.
Down with straw.
Well, it means have a
very difficult to get now, too.
Or a straw hat. Hay is grass cut or mown and dried for use mainly as fodder. Straw is the dry stems or stalks of certain kinds of cereals, though you can use it, I believe, of peas and buckwheat. And it's used for bedding, for thatching, for hats, and sometimes chopped up for fodder as well. 2 marks. Well, now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the program. And for this round, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Frank, your quotation is never, 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 which is King Lear's last speech after the death of Cordelia.
If Mr. F.P. Wilson, who's the editor of the Oxford Dictionary of English Proverbs, is listening. Will he take pen and paper? Because I've got a new one for him. It's an old English proverb, which I know he hasn't got, because I only made it up this afternoon. I feel like Ravel, you know, when he completed his bolero and tried it on and... I've always wanted to contribute something to the English language or to life and to enrich in life in some way. I tried, actually, a year or two ago by inventing a new number. It seemed to me that we were lacking a number between 4 and 5. I invented Flidge, which very roughly is 4 and a half. So it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, Flidge, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Now, the benefits of this are enormous. You know, if you're going into one of those quizzes and you reach the end of it and they say, and now the last question for a trip round the world first class or £150,000, or if it's BBC television, a free ticket to a recording of the epilogue. and they say to you, for this money, what is 1/8 of 36? Now, you'd be flummoxed, wouldn't you? 1/8 of 36 is a flidge, you see. And I thought, you know, compilers of this program and other programs like this, they've got to work with these rotten old words which have been around for years. So I thought, if I invented a new word for the dictionary, yosh, I thought of, Y-O-S-H. There's a good word, isn't it? Yosh. I mean, Scrabble people would love it. Crossword, yosh. And I've got meanings for it, too. Yosh, it's got three meanings, like most words, primary, secondary, and tertiary meaning. The first meaning of yosh is an insidious smell like that of broken glass. The second meaning of yosh is a catarrhal infection of the larynx, which you find in butterflies. And the third meaning of yosh is the Eskimo word for a collapsible opera hat. Do you know, I rang the Oxford Press, you know, and nobody was at all interested in this. And I thought, well, surely I could invent a new proverb, because we've all been stuck with these terrible, you know, don't do this and don't do that and watch pots don't boil and whatnot. I don't know, I worked at it and I got a couple. They weren't much good, you know. And then this afternoon, there was this tremendous breakthrough. I had to go and see this woman on the green in the village, Genevieve Baker. Neva, she called, who breeds chickens. And I'm entering into a lengthy negotiation to get some dozen point of lay from her. She's not an attractive lady. She's not plain. That's not at all the word. No, it's... She's hideous. She's about 16 stone, I suppose, and there's a smell of gas there, and I shouted, Neva, 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 it's me, oh light of my life, the words sticking in my throat, thinking of the negotiations for the chickens. And I went to the kitchen, and there was this great inert lump lying with her head right up against the oven, the open oven of the gas stove, and this huge smell of gas. Well, I sprung into action immediately. I rushed out and got the coat tongs and undid the top two buttons of her blouse. Then I rushed out into the garage and got the foot pump, shoved it up her nose and gave her the kiss of life. And she came round and I said, what have you been doing? What have you been up to? And she said, oh, I smelt gas. And I remembered I put the oven on. I couldn't remember lighting it about 2 hours ago, so I opened the oven door and gave a niff, and that's all I remember. I said, you silly girl. You silly woman. I said, niff a gas pipe outside, but never, ever. And then, for my mind, I suddenly conceived this new English proverb. Mr. Wilson, Mr. F.B. Wilson, are you ready with your pencil and paper? Now is the time to take it down. I said, neither, never, niffen, oven, ever.
Well, that'll make the charts. And we go on to Dennis Norden. If you remember, his quotation was, take a pair of sparkling eyes, which is Gilbert in The Gondoliers.
I suppose this one really started when my son got one of his sore throats, because who should rush into me but Glinka? Now, Glinka is the au pair girl. She's a middle-aged lady who comes from Lapland. And prior to arriving in England, she'd never before left her little wooden hut. So all of our ways are rather strange to her. But anyway, in she rushed, and she shouted out, the son, the male child, he's choking himself. Choking. Now, I must explain that Glinka had only been with us 2 months, and instead of going to evening classes for English lessons, she decided to learn the language by watching Coronation Street. come quick, she said, come quick. The firstborn, up and he's snuffing it. Well, of course, I rushed up to the bathroom immediately, as any father would, and what do I see? There's my son, and he's holding a glass of salt water, having a gargle. He says, hello, Dad. He goes, well, Glinka nearly fainted. I said, don't be silly, Glinka. He's only gargling. Well, after nearly half an hour of patient explanation, I elicited a most astonishing anthropological fact. The people of northern Lapland do not gargle. She said, can anyone do it? I said, yes. She said, you don't have to belong to an industrialized society. I said, no. I said, go ahead and try. I gave her a glass of salt water, and she had a go, and you should have seen her face. Exhilarated wasn't the word. I mean, you imagine, at the age of 45, suddenly discovering that your body can produce a wholly new noise. I must tell you, from that moment on, there was no stopping her. Every spare moment, there she was, up in the bathroom, like that, and shrieking with delight. There was no more going to discos on her day off. No more wine and blubber parties at the Anglo-Lapland Club. Every evening was spent up in her room with a giant jerry can of water and this great two-pound block of salt. But, yeah, it was harmless, you see, and she obviously enjoyed it. It could have gone on indefinitely, except for one thing. Suddenly, England found itself plunged into yet another of its periodic consumer crises, a salt shortage. And when that took hold, well, it really became a bit much, sitting there eating flavourless French fries, just so as the au pair could go on emitting throbbing trills on her uvula. So I said, I'm terribly sorry, Glinka, but I'm afraid your gargling is getting to be rather like using petrol for unessential journeys. So I'm sorry, no more salt. You'll have to find something else to goose up the lukewarm water with. And then I suddenly had an inspiration. In the kitchen, we've got a spice rack, you see. We don't really use much. We just keep it because the names on the jars are so nice, you know, like cinnamon. It always reminds me of that chap who wrote the Inspector Maigret stories, you know. And I said to her, look, why don't you use one of these spices to flavour the water with? Here, nutmeg. What about that? And she said, that would be right, Gradley. And she took it to the bathroom, and sure enough, in a few moments, drifting down the stairs, came the familiar sort of outboard motor noise. However, About a month later, we began to notice something. A sort of a definite change had come over Glinka. Gone sort of wild and kind of leering, you see. Well, I thought perhaps she might be going through the change of climate, you see. So I said to her, perhaps she ought to go and see the doctor. Well, it took, her manner being what it was, rather sullen, you see. Now, it took a bit of arguing, but finally she agreed to. And when she came back, that's when we learned another astonishing fact. Did you know that nutmeg is a mild intoxicant? It was really so. And by gargling in such quantities over the preceding month, Glinka had passed the whole 4 weeks absolutely smashed out of her mind. Well, if you think that's incredible, if you don't believe it, I can actually show you the very note which the doctor wrote telling me not to allow Glinka to continue this activity of hers. It says, take au pair off gargling spice.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Frank Muir wins the story, and he and Dillis Powell also just win the entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.